Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Now, I told you about our esteemed business review panel. They're here in the shape of Caroline Reedy, of formerly of the HR suite. And we've got a PR and corporate affairs expert in Douglas Keating. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Now, Caroline, we might start with you. Front page of the Irish Times today is telling us with some alarm that over 80% of Irish alumni went to Russia.
Absolutely. And I suppose one of the key producers is Ahanish Alumina. And obviously, it's a huge, I suppose, employer in the economy, down particularly around fines.
Yeah.
With about 1,000 jobs and maybe up to 500 contractors. And we know that the ripple effect in that community then is the local supermarket and housing and all the other things as well. But ultimately, 200 tons in the first 3 months of the year are going to Russia, and it's a Russian-owned mega giant, I suppose. So ultimately, Europe are looking for sanctions, and the Taoiseach and Taoiseach are basically saying, don't bite off your nose to spite your face, because obviously there's a benefit to the European supply chain. But we're seeing that the majority of this is going back to Russia.
Yeah, I heard Micheál Martin on the news last night talking about this, about its dependence on some Swedish company and another one in Germany, that without Ahanish Alumina, these businesses and these aluminium plants would be in trouble. But 80% of it going to Russia seems to kind of dilute that somewhat, Doug.
Well, I think there's a bit of context here as to for why this is a, you know, the front page lead story of the Irish Times, because of itself, you know, the exports are maybe not the story. It's more that back in March, the Irish Times did an investigation which suggested that, yes, the alumina is going to Russia. It's being smelted and made into aluminium. But crucially, they said that they could demonstrate that a proportion of that was going into Russian defense manufacturers. And obviously, I had assumed that we were doing, as the EU and an EU country, everything in our power to undermine Russia's military and industrial complex. But reading this story, I've learned that wasn't counter sanctions. The exports were perfectly acceptable. As the story says, 80%, 200,000 tons went in Q1 of 2026. And that the company has been pushing the government hard to make sure that the EU doesn't introduce sanctions. The story finds that there have been 10 meetings or representations made. And from what it sounds like, the comments of both the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach are supportive of the company avoiding sanctions and voicing that, or at least ready to voice that to the EU. Micheál Martin calling sanctions would be self-defeating. Simon Harris saying we shouldn't be cherry-picking, and that these are critical raw materials for European industry. However, as you do say, if 80% of this is going to Russia, how is it a critical raw material for the EU? Unless possibly it is smelted, produced, made into aluminium in Russia, and then comes back out again.
I love the language in this, Doug. Asked if the government had lobbied the European Union on behalf of Ahanish, he said it had engaged on the matter.
Well, yeah, there's
corporate speak.
A lot of linguistic torturing is done so people avoid using the word lobbying, which is viewed as a dirty word, which in fact it shouldn't be. Making your case to a government is perfectly reasonable. My takeaway was, though, that actually it seemed like the EU had no plans to sanction, and the language out of Brussels appears to agree with the Irish government that this is an important element of the European supply chain.
Yeah. Caroline, some shock in corporate circles.
Indeed.
Last week around Albert Manifold and his exit from BP. The Irish Times reporting today that several BP shareholders found ousted chairman Manifold challenging. Now, he's obviously been very defensive of his position. And we also see an article, an opinion piece by John Gapper, that BP should never have made Manifold chairman. So
This
is an interesting corporate story.
It is.
It's also interesting that during his tenure, the share price in BP increased by 29%. Now, you could say that's because of oil, but any, you know, executive who comes into a business.
Yeah.
And BP is a sizable entity, so 29% increase on its shareholding or share valuation is a huge number.
Yeah.
I suppose a few things. So what's behind all this?
Yeah, I suppose a few things. Firstly, we know how important a chair is in any board, but I suppose there's a huge distinction between a non-executive chair and an executive chair. And ultimately, I suppose, as a chair yourself of many boards, Bobby, and as a chartered director myself, one of the big things is fingers out, noses in, that concept of not getting too involved. And it sounds here the division of power and the responsibility is after manifesting into a really public showdown. I suppose tensions aren't untypical in boards like this, particularly at that level. But I suppose ultimately it seems that, you know, Albert Manifold had a track record with CRH, 10 years there, etc. I think, you know, it can be said that when they interviewed the guy for this job, the proven track record he came with, the way he does business, I suppose, was probably evident to a certain extent. But it's really, I suppose, now, you know, he's obviously saying that he was available to meet. They were saying he would only do online meetings and he wasn't willing to meet shareholders.
Yeah, there is a he said,
you know,
she
there
says
is. And there is. And I think the fact he didn't, you know, it seems that the company secretary and himself, you know, there was issues in terms of, you know, working relationship. But ultimately, 6 months in to make a call like that, it's a fairly significant one. And ultimately, the decision has been made. But I think all eyes now will be on the board to say, well, who's going to follow in his footsteps? Because ultimately, they need to get this job right. Because the next chair, as you said, has their work cut out.
Well, they've
them.
Had two CEOs and two chairs in the last 3 years, Doug.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's...
And, you know, the UK governance, corporate governance, is slightly different to our Irish one in the fact that a non-exec director, well, along with chair and CEO, can hold a kind of a golden vote, where we don't really have that here.
Yeah, look, I think you give some useful context there of why, for BP, an iconic UK company, why this is getting so much attention. Two CEOs gone, Bernard Looney, a controversy around relationships with colleagues. 2025, Murray Auchincloss, I don't know if I've got that right, was also ousted, you know, I think over the sort of pace of the transformation he was making. And also the chairman, Helge Lund, went in 2025 and 24% of shareholders had voted against a motion at the AGM supportive of him. So there is a context here where BP is seen to have been lacking in direction and corporate governance. John Gapper's column, I mean, his thesis seems to be that, look, you know, it was pretty clear with Albert Manifold what you were getting, you know, a very driving, demanding executive.
Through CRH
had made huge transformations, yeah, but had never been a chairman of a company, crucially never, you know, this non-executive role that we see in UK corporate governance. And I think John Gapper's thesis is that, you know, maybe the actions he took, maybe he is very hands-on. There was the word shouty used in one of the articles to describe his behavior. You know, was he capable of taking the normal role that a chairman should take? Having said that, if you're a shareholder and the share price is up 29%, admittedly, you know, helped by the higher oil price, you might say, look, I don't really care if he's breaking some eggs. This business needs someone aggressive to turn it round, and Manifold maybe is doing it. But shareholders have said in the article, you know, that they found dealing with him challenging and they found getting meetings challenging. So yeah, maybe he wasn't all that shareholders wished for.
All right. Inflation, Caroline. It slowed in May as energy prices dipped, yet prices of energy we see UNO Energy hiking prices,
yeah,
by 11%. Electric Ireland said it's putting up, it's going to increase by 8%, and residential gas bills will go by up by 7.7% on July the 1st. So, you know, we've one thing telling us that inflation has slowed, and then we're seeing prices go up. So that doesn't kind of really gel for me.
No, I suppose we're seeing from the CSO that consumer goods and services are up 12%, but ultimately, I think for a lot of people, we've already just recently heard the Eurostat, you know, reports that Ireland has the highest cost of electricity, more than 40% higher than the average. And for people listening to hear that their electricity is now going to be going up, Electric Ireland increasing its prices, and now Uno Energy. Uno Energy are saying since they joined the market in August 23, this is the first increase. And obviously it's all down to the war and the geopolitical scenario. But I think the big challenge with this is the cost of wages. And, you know, for people, we've seen energy bills and people's ability to pay back. It's the second highest in arrears for people. So you can definitely see the concern happening out there.
It looks like it's going to get worse rather than better.
Absolutely.
Let's go to a business story, Doug. Hammerson striking a $45 million deal to secure full ownership of the ILEC Centre. Apparently they've bought out Irish Life's 50% stake. I was trying to work out, was it a good or a bad buy based on the fact that the previous sale of the ILEC Centre was a NAMA one, but it was involved in a portfolio of shopping centres at $1.85 billion. So even given that was a few shopping centres, it still seems to me to be a fairly discounted price.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The you know, Hammerson is a name that people may not be familiar, but is a very large UK property company listed in London that you may not also realise it plays a very big role in Irish retail, because when it bought that portfolio, which was called Project Jewel, which was the loans that, of Joe O'Reilly and Chartered Land that were in NAMA, they paid $1.85 billion to take control of a bunch of assets, of which the trophy asset was Dundrum Town Centre,
sure,
which many of us will be familiar with, but also it included this 50% stake in the ILEC Centre. I agree with you that in the context of, you know, a near 2 billion euro portfolio acquisition, of which the ILEC Centre must have been a reasonable portion, I would imagine that the 90 million euro valuation that this putative transaction would put on it is probably lower than that was paid then. However, to look at the positives, I guess the fact that Hammerson are, you know, willing to write the check and, you know, invest more money into a major retail asset, perhaps, you know, shows there's life in the retail sector yet. And this large store in the centre of North Dublin, you know, with anchor tenants like Dunn's, you know, maybe they have exciting plans for its regeneration. Actually, the most interesting point in this story for me, just to be quirky, was that where the name the ILEC Centre came from. Because what I hadn't realised is that the name comes from it being called after an acronym of Irish Life Assurance Company, which was the company that originally built it all those years ago. So
only an anorak like you would be impressed by something. Now, Caroline, AI job displacement. Interesting piece by Emmett Malone in today's Irish Times. AI job displacement. Every employer, every worker should be talking about this. We also have a piece by Cliff Taylor, our regular go-to man,
yeah,
which is pointing out really, really some quite alarming stats around AI. So let's start with Emmett Malone. What was your take on his piece?
I completely agree, I suppose.
Tell our listeners about the thrust of what he's saying.
Yeah, so I suppose I completely agree with Emmett's concept of every employer and every worker should be talking about AI. I mean, we're seeing that the IMF are saying 40% of jobs are being impacted by AI. Department of Finance are saying 60%. Arguably, very close to 100% of jobs are going to be impacted unless you do a very hands-on job. And even still, the admin and the background, you know, elements of that job will be impacted by AI. I think the biggest part of this, you know, both by Emmett and Cliff, is the pace of change and the urgency that's required. Because ultimately, I suppose, the big companies in Ireland that we're so dependent on for our corporate corporation tax, are really embracing AI and investing hugely in it. And I suppose it's the pace of change. So as a consequence of it, I suppose new roles are being created. You know, we've got new job titles now like prompt engineers and answer engine optimization specialists, etc.
I've never heard of either of those before I read this article.
And I suppose ultimately, though, even no matter what job you do. I know even in our own roles now, like definitely a huge amount of the admin tasks, it's, you know, being maximized by AI. And the challenge now is what are people doing with the efficiencies that it's creating? Obviously, some companies are looking to redeploy and change, but others are looking at redundancy and I suppose looking at changes around that. Graduate and entry roles are probably the ones most impacted. You know, this week we see a lot of people and they're finished college, they're going in to do their final exams or just about, and they're saying we're finding it really hard to get those entry level jobs. So the big advice really is no matter what job you're doing, the upskilling piece. And the government are being challenged this week to say there's a 3 billion surplus at the end of this decade in the National Training Fund.
We should be spending that.
We should be spending it big time to accelerate integration.
Can I just read out a line here from Cliff Taylor? Like the advent of the internet, nobody disputes that artificial intelligence is going to have a fundamental impact on all our lives. It's just that no one is quite sure yet exactly what it'll look like.
Yeah, I mean,
that's the summary of it for me.
Yeah, I mean, the premise of Cliff's article is sort of looking at the parallels with the dot-com boom, where, you know, obviously massive investment. I mean, he cites, you know, Meta's spending $125 billion on AI this year. So in the same way, there was massive investment in all these pets.com, etc. There was also massive hype about IPOs coming to the market, just as we're seeing now with SpaceX, OpenAI, Anthropic, a $1 trillion putative valuation on OpenAI, which is mental. But as Cliff says, you know, the big question is, you know, we know this is going to do something, but what is the productivity drivers we'll see and who will capture the value from that? And that's the great uncertainty. Lots of companies lost huge amounts of money in the dot-com boom. And yet there's no disputing that the internet has changed the world. It's just the companies that really benefited from, you know, weren't necessarily the ones that were hot at that time.
Yeah. So one sort of thesis is that, you know, if a company has a huge spend on AI, regardless of what it does, that one of the only ways to get that back is to cut staff.
Well, that's exactly what's happening. I mean, Meta cutting around 8,000 jobs globally between its Irish operations and the subcontractor it uses, maybe 1,000 jobs going here.
The other thing he says here is that the hope value of AI is one of the key factors in keeping the markets where they are.
Well, there's no, you know, the spreadsheets and assumptions you have to make to justify an OpenAI value of $1 trillion are, you know, that it is an art, not a science. And a lot of it is hope and expectation rather than grounded in clear, you know, financial reality.
Yeah.
Caroline, a new breed of Irish publican is shaking up the Irish pub trade. Now, I'm a big fan of the traditional Irish pub and I really do love it. And I'm of a particular age, maybe. That I'm one of those people, but I also am encouraged that there are new people coming into this business and have a different attitude and are shaking it up a bit.
Yeah.
Tell us more.
This is a really good article by John Maher, who's basically talking about the fact that we've seen a big societal change and obviously a challenge around business costs for pubs in general, with alcohol consumption down, more people drinking low or no alcohol. And ultimately, I suppose, one in four pubs have closed in the last 20 years, but we're seeing a rejuvenation of a new type of pub. And I think it's a really nice article that's giving us confidence in the innovation and creativity out there. And I suppose it's the concept of the heart of the community with a purpose vibe. And some of these examples are Macara in Dundalk, where they're basically looking at a hub, not a pub, where they're doing lots of food markets, comedy nights, pop-up kitchens.
Yeah, well,
events.
Working hard to get people in the door.
Absolutely. And I suppose what they're also doing, though, is combining that with a range of craft beers. They're also, I suppose, working collaboratively with other small businesses. And they're saying it's paying off, similar to Tomáisín's in Dingle, where they, again, innovatively have the Irish touch with Korean and local Dingle beers. So again, I suppose it's trying to, I suppose, provide something different.
Yeah.
And the customers responding to it. Like, there's really positive feedback here from these owners to say they're getting the benefit of the risks that they're taking around that.
Doug, John Maher tells us that Killian Mulligan, a new breed, typical of a new breed of young publican, it's not enough anymore to simply open up and hope to survive on drink sales. You need to think of food, live events, and innovative collaborations. Even long-established premises often require a new way of thinking if they're to survive in an Ireland where the pub is no longer central to life as it was. I think that's maybe one of the key points.
Yeah, look, I really admire these young entrepreneurs who are setting up these pubs and trying to innovate and you know, trying to make the pub relevant to their local community against a backdrop of, you know, reducing alcohol consumption and a reduced focus on maybe the pub as the centre of Irish life. I just wanted to highlight one of the nice innovations that Ger Haw in Offaly at Haw's Pub has made. So one of the sort of innovations they have is white collar boxing fights they organise. And I love this. One participant in the recent fight was the local Father Pepper, the priest, who, given his surname Pepper, went under the fight name Jalapeno. So beat that.
Stop. Sorry, I'm laughing too much. Caroline, call time on this endless hamster wheel and the tyranny of the pointless meeting. There's a great piece today in the Irish Independent. In 1930, Maynard Keynes predicted that we'd all be working 3 hours a day in 2030, and we're only a few years off.
Yeah, we need to get our timelines right. I suppose what Richard Curran is saying, I think every single reader is going to agree that the amount of meetings we go to and attend that are pointless. I think the big thing we've seen with the AI article and with this is the importance of productivity, and time is getting more so important, and people making sure that they're using AI and using their time more wisely. I think the basics...
He quotes Microsoft research stating that meetings have gone up by 133% since COVID.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah, but I think as well, partly because it's online, you know, he mentions here that there's an awful lot of meetings in the diary and they're online repeats. I love Ryanair mentions they have an online weekend meeting for the senior execs, but equally the concept is it brings a focus and a discipline because no one's going to be wanting to waste their time over the weekend. I just think, though, back to the concept of have you an agenda, you know, is it necessary? And I think AI can help a lot
here. Dread here is he talks about the FaceTime meeting now, that there's now the pre-meeting before the meeting and then the post-meeting to review what went
wrong.
Anybody
who does that should be shot.
This is death by meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, it is, but as Caroline said, and I think Owen McDermott of the Communications Clinic is quoted in the piece talking about it, it's good meeting management, you know, appropriate chairing of meetings, agendas, thinking about whether everyone needs to attend those repeat meetings where, you know, the 10 people are
same
on that
cast,
invite.
Same team, same people.
Yeah. And the article also says, you know, what some of the research showing, you know, if you put an hour in the diary, you know, a vacuum will be filled. So, you know, you'll fill that hour, but will it necessarily be a useful hour? Who knows? So trying to think about whether do you need that hour or could it be done in 20 minutes?
Yeah, and I think we're really checking if the online workers are actually working. There's an insecurity around that.
Yeah.
People are calling meetings to make sure the people working from home.
Proof of life.
Are actually working.
Yeah, you hope we're going to move past that past.
You heard it here, folks. Big thanks to my Business Review panel, Caroline Reedy and Doug Keating. Thank you very much. Enjoy your
weekend.
Thank
you, Bobby.
Thanks, Bobby.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr. Sponsored by Bank of Ireland. Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. Conversation that counts.